Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Sharing the Dharma with Our Imprisoned Brothers by Lama Tom Broadwater, Jim Dunn, and Eric Weinberg. In this very special Dharma Talk, Lama Tom, Jim, and Eric reflect on the work of the Columbus KTC Prison Project and share accounts of some of their most profound experiences with the prisoners. They discuss the impact the Dharma had on the inmates they came to know and consider the future of this important outreach program. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Welcome this morning, and good to see you all here. Beautiful day. What we do as Buddhists, we begin by checking our motivation. Why am I here? And the point is, we're here for the benefit of all beings. And we come here with a mind that's open, loving, kind, and happy. There's all kinds of reasons to be happy, but the basic reason is we got up this morning and we're alive. And we can, because of that, be of benefit to one another. And the way we sort of summarize that open, loving, and inclusive heart is by reciting the refuge prayer. So it's in your little, it's on your seat there, and we can say this together. And we'll say it in English three times. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment by the merit of generosity and other good deeds. May I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment by the merit of generosity and other good deeds. May I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment by the merit of generosity and other good deeds. May I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Before we begin, why don't we just take a moment to relax? We came in off the street. We've got all kinds of things that may have happened before we got here. And we want to sort of drop those for the moment and allow ourselves the spaciousness that does exist potentially in our own mind. So for just a moment, let's just relax. Not worrying about what happened up to this point or what's going to happen after we leave here, but just be here present. Even drop that idea of being present. And just relax.
Well, good morning, everybody. Originally, this was my Sunday to give a Dharma talk. And when I was talking to Lama Kathy, who also wanted to be a part of this conversation, but she's currently teaching on Zoom a class for the Dallas KTC. When I was talking to her, she said, "You know, it'd be good to talk about the Prison Project." And so I thought about that. I've kind of been the head of the prison project. My name is Eric Weinberg. This is Lama Tom Broadwater and Jim Dunn. And we've all worked on this for years and years. I think Jim was one of the first people, somewhere between 15 and 20 years ago, that began visiting prisons. And since that time, a lot of people have been involved, including Bradley Butters and Lama Karma, a Theravadan monk named Venerable Kai Zhao, Ed Powers, who is a former director of the center here. Who am I leaving off? I don't know what I do with my piece of paper, my cheat sheet.
I got it right here.
You want the notes?
Oh, thank you. Oh, well, that's all that was on the paper. Anyway, we started out just as visitors, and then we became visitors and volunteers. I'm not going to get into the specific details of what that difference is, but originally we started visiting individuals, and eventually we wound up visiting individuals, and a Buddhist group was formed by the prisoners and requested help from us down in Chillicothe. So pretty close, an hour from here. So we've done both. And what we thought we would do today is just tell a couple of our favorite stories. We don't have enough time, obviously, to be comprehensive, and you would get bored anyway. So we'll tell a couple stories. And we'd also like to invite anybody who's interested in volunteering for this good work, because as you can probably notice, we're kind of aging out. And so as you hear these stories and appreciate just how ennobling and enriching this is, not just for the people we visit, but especially for us, we hope that some of you may find some inspiration in that in general, and possibly want to talk more later to us about how to become a volunteer or a visitor or a pen pal. So,
Eric, why don't we begin by telling a little bit about the places we've been to and what's that like just walking into a prison?
I think I was actually one of the first in all of this, and I think I kind of began it. I was sitting out there one day. Kathy Jackson was the director at that time, and she said something about a pen pal program or writing of a prisoner. And I found her saying, "Thank you, Jim," and handing me a bunch of letters. So that's how I kind of got started in this. I'm not even quite sure why I put up my hand, but I did. And that's how we started. I got writing with a few prisoners, some on death row, some in other prisons. And then we got invited. There was a prisoner in the Corrections Medical Center down off 71 near Frank Road. The prisoner there, a Chinese man, Han Wan Z, we called him Z. Actually, I came to find out his name is Shia, but everybody called him Z, and that's kind of how I think of him still. So we went down and visited him, and I got to know him. I became basically his spiritual advisor and friend. And he was the first one we gave refuge to. That was kind of fun. We were in the prison barber shop getting a chaplain, Rose Hamilton, there to smuggle in some scissors so we could clip his hair. Scissors are not usually commonly found in prisons for obvious reasons. But that was the first refuge ceremony. And Z turned out to be an extraordinarily dedicated student. He completed Nundro, I think, in about a year. And he had come to Ohio, to Columbus, to go to graduate school. He's working on his doctorate in engineering. His wife had an affair. He got a little upset, went out one morning, bought a gun, and went down to visit her lover, who ran a restaurant downtown, a Chinese restaurant, and put a bullet in his head. So he was sentenced to 20 years to life. He wound up doing 20 years and then was promptly deported to China. Several years after he was deported, I had the opportunity to go to China and visit him. So that was a really remarkable thing to see him as a free man trying to rebuild a life. It was really quite difficult. But I always found that got me started in this, and I always found it extraordinarily rewarding, enriching for me, and inspiring. I mean, we all have some problems maintaining our practice, and watching this man's dedication to it was just kind of incredible and inspiring. And that's kind of what you find in some of these things.
Jim, sort of taking us in a direction of looking at memorable events. So, Eric, can you sort of describe how you began and a memorable person that you've met at?
Well, I first visited prison at the invitation of Paul Goldstein, I saw him here earlier today. He might be doing something else right now. And then there was a break. In the meantime, I myself became a Buddhist and part of this community. And one day, Lama Kathy walked in and said, anybody want to volunteer to visit prison? We have an invitation. It turned out that the prison we were going to visit is over 3 hours away. And it was in Youngstown, Ohio, where I actually grew up. So that was interesting, and I had a little bit of experience and really enjoyed Paul Goldstein's group, so I said, sure. And the first time I went, though, it was a lot different. Each prison is a different environment. The state pen up in Youngstown is a supermax prison. And when you stand outside and look at it, you know its architecture is foreboding on purpose. It's big concrete walls and slitty windows and very large, heavy, clanging doors and things like that. And we went in. We were met by the chaplain there. And she wanted us to visit death row because some prisoners there had asked for meditation instruction. They had a guy from Cleveland that was going to come down. Cleveland's only an hour away from there. But he decided it would just a little bit heavy for him to be visiting death row. Anyway, I think there were four or five of us on this trip, and including these two characters. And we got in there and through a bunch of just noises that you never have heard before. Because when these big, heavy doors open and close, they just make a lot of noise. And unlike, say, your house, where we try to make things not squeak, they don't worry about stuff like that.
Right? It's like an echo chamber.
What's that?
It's like an echo
chamber. And then, yeah, the meditation environment was, they took us up and we were on this floor, like a mezzanine floor, that floats kind of in space with two stories down and two stories above. In other words, when you're there, you're there. You're not going anywhere. And they had four or five what they call bird cages. Mm-hmm. And they paraded these prisoners in, all manacled and shackled. They were manacled with their hands behind them, and they were shackled by their feet. And they put each one into an individual cage and shut the doors. Then they put their hands through the slot and they undid their manacles and put them back through so that they could have their hands in front to hold materials that we brought for them to read, you know, simple things like the refuge prayer. And my own experience of all that was, it was quite shocking to see that one human would treat another human like that, albeit these were all people convicted of murder, you know. But by the same token, while they were in prison, they wanted to grow, even though they were in a difficult environment for growth. And so they requested us.
One thing that I would say about that too, despite the enormous inhumanity of all of that, when you were there and in front and we were meditating or teaching or whatever we were doing, there was a sense of the sacred, even in that crazy environment. You would hear people yelling and screaming all around you. You know, the torment of these folks was obvious, just listening to the echoes. But when we said the refuge prayer or when we meditated, there was that feeling of the sacred.
Yeah. It was a powerful experience. And it's a long drive. It's a long day when you go there. We don't go there anymore. But back in those days, you know, it was like 6 hours in the car that day and probably about 6 hours there. There's long days, but it was so powerful and it seemed so sacred what we were doing that we didn't really think about it too much. And we went every month, right through the winter and snowstorms and, you know, all of that kind of thing. Right through calamitous times for me and my business. I remember Bradley Butters driving the car, and I would tether up my laptop to my cell phone so I could work while I was driving on the way there.
It was about a four-hour drive, wasn't it?
About three.
3 hours?
Three and a half, yeah.
Yeah. Between us, we'll get the rest somehow.
It's a long drive.
It's a long drive.
Yeah. No. One way.
No, it's a little farther than Cleveland. If you've driven up to Cleveland, so it's a little farther than that.
Yeah.
So, Eric.
I remember other times we were up there. We met with a bunch of guys on death row, just sitting kind of like we are now. And the first time when we met with these guys, and these guys were some of the worst. At least that's how the prison had categorized them, and they were in the little bird cages. But other times we were just sitting, and they were sitting like in chairs right across from us. And it was just kind of talking to a bunch of guys.
Yeah,
it sounds rather dramatic talking to these guys, but it always struck me. I always felt safe in a prison, much safer than I do on the outside, oddly enough. The only thing that bothers me is when you go in, that door shuts, and there's a kind of finality that I'm not getting out of here unless they let me. But there is something dramatic about the way that shuts. And to get into a prison, you go through what they call a sally port, where you go through one door, it closes, it locks, and then they open up another door to let you out into the prison, so.
Yeah.
Eric, can you tell us a story about some of the folks or one of the memorable folks that you met?
Well, yeah. So just following on that first visit, Jeannie always used to say to me every time I left, don't stay too long. But one of the guys that was in that first group, what Jim said is right. There were two guys in particular that weren't there to learn meditation. They were there because they were gang members and they wanted to communicate. And other than that religious opportunity, which the state of Ohio says they must be afforded if they want it, other than that, they didn't get to see each other and plot heinous crimes. So they wanted to use our meditation thing. However, in between these two, the guards were smart enough to separate them, so they really even couldn't communicate. In between those two were a couple other guys. And one of them, these were all death row guys, one of them is named Carl. Carl's actually still with us. And I want to tell you a little bit about his experience. And I want to also say that of the five or six guys on death row we worked with, one had his sentence changed and he was moved and we didn't see him. One decided he wanted to become a Muslim because the imams would feed him better. Literally, he told me that. We didn't bring any inducements to come to our groups. And then of the four others, three have been executed, and we've been a part of that. That's a whole other story. Carl's still with us. After we first taught meditation, the first time back, we were sitting in that group kind of situation that Jim was talking about. And these are all guys who chose to be Buddhist after they went to prison. What happened for each of them was they realized their life wasn't working, obviously. And so they'd go to the library and read about all the religions to see what made sense to them, what would help them. And these guys came to the point where they thought the Buddha Dharma could help. So they all showed up at this grouping that we had. And after we taught meditation again, you know, a little bit deeper than we did when they were up in the cages, Carl raised his hand. And he said two or three things. One was, he said, thank you. And he said, this is the first time I've ever been glad that I'm in prison. He said, I never would learn this if I was on the street. And if I was on the street doing what I used to be doing, I'd be dead now anyway. And then he said, this is the most powerful thing I ever learned. I never knew I could let go of a thought. Boy, if that doesn't make sense for somebody who's followed his thinking so far that he ended up murdering somebody, you know, he really, like, it hit him hard.
He was a remarkable person.
Yeah.
Now, I remember when we first met, Lama Kathy and I had gone up there alone just to see what death row was like, and we were going to meet with one prisoner, but we couldn't. He had been misbehaving that day, and the guards wouldn't give us access to him. But Carl was interested, and they got Carl. I guess he was taking a shower. He was supposed to be expecting us, but he didn't believe we'd actually come. Mm-hmm. Prisoners get very used to disappointment. But they brought him out, he saw us, sat down, and he actually cried.
The second time that I saw Carl, outside of the cages, I mean, so it would have been the third time, he said, I have a question. I said, what's that? He said, this really troubles me. I said, what's that? And he said, I feel so much better now. I'm meditating every day. I'm looking at him like, so what's the problem? He said, but my victims are still so full of anger at me and hatred and resentment that I know their lives are miserable because of what I did. What can I do for them? And we talked about dedicating the merit of his meditation for the benefit of his victims specifically. And he began to do that.
Carried on a process, actually, of a reconciliation.
Yeah.
You want to speak about that?
Just briefly so you guys can, yeah. So after years, I mean, I'm losing track now, but it must have been 6-7 years out of the blue. These people that were the relatives of the guy that he killed contacted the state and said they wanted to meet with him and go through a process of reconciliation, which the state does provide, but it has to be initiated by the victims, and it has to be, you know, there's a lot of interviews and a lot of forms to fill out, you know, to protect everybody involved, a lot of social workers involved and so forth. Anyway, one of the things that Carl had to do was to allocute to the murder. In other words, he never confessed, okay? He did it, but he didn't confess. And that left open the chance of appeal if he ever got, you know, to an execution. If his date ever came up, he'd have grounds for an appeal if he never allocated to the crime. In order to do the reconciliation, he had to confess. And he so deeply wanted these people to be happier that he did that. And they met two times.
It's really a turning point, I think, in the way he viewed things. I think it's really different.
It was remarkable. And they apparently came away knowing him and knowing his circumstance and understanding what was going on at that time.
It doesn't happen often, but when it does happen, it's really seems like a miracle.
Yeah.
Could I tell my little story about
it? Oh, please, yeah.
Carl did, it was horrible, the crime he committed. It was in every respect horrible. But I can tell you, and I'm being very honest about this, if Carl were ever to get out, which is unlikely, but if he were ever to get out, he could be my next door neighbor, and I would feel very comfortable about that. But he told a story, and this is, and I'll try to get to it quickly, but he had a really horrible life, as many of these death row inmates have horrible lives. But he told a story one time that he was living with relatives, I think it was his grandparents, and they got tired of him and his siblings, and they just took them in the car and dropped them off without any introduction to their other set of grandparents. And Carl said he wasn't doing this to gain pity, but just to tell us the truth. It was a part of the process he had to go through to mediate with the relatives. Mm-hmm. So I saw that, and I saw how we often understand the side, we only see the side that's seen in the papers, the horrible crime they committed. But we don't see what's behind that crime, which is often abused, neglected lives. And that made me see the death row inmates in an entirely different light. 99%, probably 100% of them have lives that were horribly misshapen.
Mm-hmm.
But subsequent to that reconciliation, I just see it, I saw a softness and a kindness and a love in Carl that was inspiring, actually. I mean, we talk about what we did for them. No, it's oftentimes what the inmates did for us. And Carl did that for me.
Yeah. Well, we talk a lot about Buddha nature in this tradition. Yeah. And part of what we discover in there is that these people who, you know, the image we often use is cloudy days, you can't see the sun. We actually are helping some of these people remove their clouds and realize their basic goodness.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't all death row. I've spent a number of days in prisons, both in Ohio and in New Mexico. I went through a chaplaincy program in New Mexico and did a lot of work there. And very few of the people, while I was in New Mexico, they repealed the death penalty. I think they had two people left on death, what they call death row. It wasn't really a row, but I've spent a lot of time with just working with prisoners there. And also here, went to Allen Prison, had a group of meditators, three or four or five of them at various times. And again, it was just, these were people, they did bad things, but the question I ask when I've been challenged on this is, how would you like to be judged by the worst thing you ever did? And I think most of us here would probably not want to be known as that. And then if you just think about it logically, I think most of us at one time or another took something that wasn't theirs, they stole. One time or another, most of you probably said something that wasn't true. And should I think of you all then as lying thieves? I mean, we try not to judge, we try to accept as they present themselves, and generally they present themselves as pretty decent people. And you try to keep that there. I spent a lot of time with one man in New Mexico that I don't have confidence in getting out, but could see some progress. But he had gone through a lot of abuse. And as somebody once said, hurt people hurt people. Mm-hmm. And so we have to let the healing begin, have to find a way to heal. And prison is not a good place for that.
Jim, I think what you were saying too, and I fully agree with it, which is we are not our worst acts. And Carl was not. He cannot be defined by the worst act he ever committed, despite the fact that because of what he did, the consequence was that he was judged for the rest of his life for that. But we nonetheless can see that other side. Eric, you've been to three different executions.
Yeah.
What was that like?
That's horrible.
Yeah, of course.
In our tradition, well, first of all these people became my friends. In each case, this is funny, on death row, it's amazing. Every single one of them, to one degree or another, had become an artist. It was one of the ways that they began to express themselves once some of those clouds were clearing in their minds. So Kenny Burros was the first one that was executed. At the time that he was executed, he'd become literally a museum-quality origami sculpture. He made some for some of us, and he used to make them for a senior center in Youngstown, and they used to sell them for thousands of dollars in order to support the senior center. Bret Hartman taught himself to be an oil painter, and he started painting like Buddhist deities and using the painting as a method of meditation. He would say a mantra for every brush stroke. We kind of taught him how to do that. Robert Van Hook started writing and playing music, and Carl Lindsay taught him how to play guitar. Carl still plays guitar, and he makes beautiful little sculptures. The only wood he's allowed to have are popsicle sticks. So he builds stuff out of popsicle sticks that are just amazing. So this art, these people are coming alive. They're really not the same people that did the crime. And the state takes a long time to execute prisoners. And by the time that this happens, they're taking somebody who is really benefiting a lot of other people in a lot of ways, and punishing them for something they did when they were completely obscured and completely mentally imprisoned and in pain. And it feels so wrong. I'm just going to tie this up quickly. One of the most important things is that we teach them meditation, and there are also particular meditations in this particular tradition of Buddhism that you can learn at a certain point in your development. There are certain meditations for the time of death. And so with those guys on death row in particular, we were given permission and encouragement to teach those to them. And so when they were there And I was in the death house with them and then in the death chamber with them. We were meditating together as they were being executed. I think it meant they had a good death. You've seen some things on TV probably, or you could if you wanted to, of what that looks like. These guys went with a sense of dignity and a sense of peace without so much of the horror and non-acceptance that most people have to go through in that situation. So what we bring to the prisons is really valuable. Now, that's also especially true of people who aren't on death row, by the way, and that's really important. There's not that many people on death row, right? Well, there's a lot of people in prison. So at Chillicothe, for instance, we had a group, and we began to teach them Buddhism. And these are all guys who went through that same process that became interested in Buddhism as a path that they felt could help them. Some of them have, you know, been released, some of the guys that we've had in groups and so forth. And so they carried that gift with them back into life, and I think it's helpful.
We did two refuge ceremonies there too.
Lama Tom gave refuge to these guys, did two refuge ceremonies for the group, which was an awesome thing. I'm just awesome.
Did it feel good?
It was. It felt good. And ultimately, we were able to buy them cushions to sit on the floor of the place where we met and also have a retreat. It took years to get that approved.
Eric, I'd like to just real quickly tell another story.
Oh, do.
It's about Robert. And I was privileged enough to go with Eric for his execution, and we had time with him right before he was to be executed. And it was something very special. Yeah. There was a quietness about him, a peace about him. And we did a puja with him,
mm-hmm.
and Amitabha, basically with the wish that he enter Amitabha's realm. And so he was at peace, and wow, at one point he stood up, he was crying, mm-hmm. he stood up, and he gave me a hug. And I don't know how to describe it other than it just felt like I fell back into my body. Mm-hmm. There I was, really present to this person. And it just seemed so crazy that later on I sat in the parking lot. He wanted Eric to be with him at the time of his death, so Eric went with him. And so I was outside, and there was a group of us, some of the people who were protesting the fact that there was capital punishment in Ohio. We were standing outside, and we sang some Christian hymn. I'm not sure what it was. But anyway, we saw him being taken out. And the whole idea of the stupidity of doing that sort of thing just struck me. And the thought that so much effort went into his execution, and so little or no effort was put into helping him when he could have used it when he was younger. Sort of crazy. Sorry, sort of went off the on this. But
the prison system is very problematic, to say the least. And so we can try to bring in a little bit of help and a little bit of love and kindness and compassion. So I'm kind of hoping at least a few people might be inspired to carry on the project.
And even if prison isn't your thing, which is totally understandable, there are people who visited with us that didn't really want to continue. Totally understandable. It's a heavy vibe. But that's why it's important to choose some way. You know, maybe little kids are your thing, you know? See if there's a place to volunteer where you can help little kids that may be in harm's way.
Yeah, you know, sort of mentioned
anything.
You sort of mentioned this. These folks sometimes, through their art, grow. It's been a proven fact that yoga and drama and so forth for kids who have been traumatized can be enormously helpful. So doing things like that in the community, meditation or underserved populations who need the arts, those kind of things, that's really important. Better to give it on the with younger kids than to wait until they're in prison.
Yeah, I mean, I really wish there was no prison ministry anywhere in any church or synagogue or Buddhist center or mosque. It'd be way better if we treated kids better and each other better, and crime kind of went down instead of, you know, keeping its presence in our culture. So everything, anything that you may want to do is precious. It's just precious. And it's worth thinking about in this community, in most Buddhist communities, since Buddhism's kind of an inside job, a lot of times we don't think about ways that we can benefit others in reaching out. But I think it's actually an important part of the path, and something that should be part of everybody's contemplation of what they're doing.
Well, and I think Lama Kathy said that she has a couple of letters that from prisoners that we've received. They drift in. We would actually start corresponding, the word would get out, and we could probably develop quite a good pen pal program if people are willing to write.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand it's, when I used to do this, it always had to be by snail mails. I'm not sure what the rules are now. I know it's possible to do emails with prisoners, but.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, does anybody have any questions about this? We've been doing a lot of talking and.
A questioner asked, you said you taught meditation. Did you also teach Buddhism in general?
Yes.
Yeah, we've taught the whole, you know, when I've gone into prison, start with meditation and but go through the whole thing, the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths. I usually try to keep it simple without getting into too much of the elaborate teachings that we get into in this tradition, but you try to figure what serves and what they'll need and what they can hear.
One of the things that, without fail, was the most powerful teaching every time, even if for people who heard it more than once, was the four thoughts that turn the mind. And it was remarkable, you know, when we think about those. So, you know, precious human birth. In other words, you're alive and you have a good mind and you've heard this extraordinary teaching about clearing the clouds and liberation, and you know that life is fragile and impermanent. Second thought. The third one is what you think, do, and say matters, karma. And the last one is the defects of samsara. Now, the defects of samsara, of course, is just that we try to do everything right so we get all the goodies, and then we do everything right and we still don't get all the goodies. And it's just that samsaric life is unsatisfactory. Well, that's a subtle thing for most of us. We're sitting out here, we have it pretty good. And it's like, what do you mean, defects? This is all really pretty good. I got a nice place to stay, I got good food to eat, you know. I know nice people. In prison, it's just the opposite, where for prisoners, that is is the most obvious thing. Yeah, this thing doesn't work. And it works backwards. But every time we talked about all four of those and wound up with the thing that was most hard for them to understand is that their human life was precious. And they finally began to taste that a little bit. It was very powerful.
One other thing I would say in regards to that, I don't disagree with you, but one of the powerful teachings that we gave prisoners was on their Buddha nature.
Yeah.
The fact that they have this heart that's kind, loving, it goes against everything that society says about them up to this point. They're bad, they need to be separated, they're punished and so forth. And so when Eric, I, or Jim would mention something about this good heart that they have, you could see people's eyes sort of lighten up. I'm not, you know, there is something here. When we did Shinrezig, which is to expose that heart, that loving heart, they loved it.
Yeah.
A lot of them didn't understand what we were doing precisely, but they got a hold of the idea that they did have this heart that was loving and kind. So for many, that was a light bulb going off, you might say.
So yeah, we teach
something
meditation.
I always talked about quite a bit was Buddha nature, or for some of them, using the Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche's phrase, your basic goodness, and connecting with that, which they can relate to. So that is one of the key things, is to get these people that everybody has kind of dismissed and remind them that they actually are valuable human beings, that they do have a precious human life, and they have some source of way for redemption.
Yeah, there is so much shame involved in being in prison. And despite the bravado we'll see among the inmates, there is this basic shame that often gets exposed in different ways. And if we can meet that with saying you are of value and this is why you are of value, it's worth a lot. You know, we planted seeds. I don't know. We talk about, we gave refuge to a number of folks. But even more importantly, perhaps, is the fact that we planted seeds for folks. And that that someday, knowing how karma works, that will bear fruit.
I always thought of my work in the prison as planting seeds. A lot of times it was throwing seeds on concrete. But every now and then there'd be a crack in the concrete and something would sprout. And sometimes you would see that it actually took a year or two, but they would come back. They would remember something I said. And that's just kind of throwing out the seeds. If you don't throw them out, they aren't going to take root for sure. But yeah.
A questioner asked, can you speak about how they reacted to Buddhist teachings on karma?
They generally understood it. I mean, one of the things they say in prison a lot is, you know, what goes around comes around. And they kind of understand the consequences to their actions. So, yeah, karma was not a difficult thing for them. Straightening them out on it a little bit, some of them thought karma was always bad. But, you know, you get good karma too, so. But yeah, they all kind of understand that actions have consequences, and as they work on cultivating better actions, they'll get better results.
A questioner said she wanted to thank the speakers for all they had done and that she was touched and inspired. She went on to tell a story. She has been riding a prisoner for 12 years, and recently he was hungry and went through the lunch line twice, and for that, they put him in solitary confinement. She also recommended a book entitled Razor Wire Dharma, saying it was a tremendous book to read about how Buddhism can change the lives of prisoners.
Can you repeat the question, Eric?
Yeah. Well, it was just, she was saying that she's been writing a prisoner for 12 years, and that a lot of things, they need support. This one particular fellow was hungry and went through the food line twice and got caught. And because he was caught, they threw him in solitary confinement. Believe me, that is, for most inmates, quite difficult. And then you mentioned a book, Razor Wire Dharma, right? Yeah, that is a good book. I was going to say about karma that I had a pen pal in California, a guy I couldn't visit, but he wrote in, and we had a long relationship. And I'd send him books, and he was in a he was in a dorm, and he'd put the books on the shelf, and there were a lot of prisoners of other religions that thought Dharma books were somehow dark or evil, or, you know, would bring a lot of bad energy into the dorm. So he came in one time and found his books thrown in the dumpster and his shelf destroyed. And he reacted badly to that, beat the guy up, and he got thrown in the hole. And he wrote me about this. At that time, for this particular pen pal, he'd asked for a teacher, and I'm not that guy. So he asked Kempo Carthar Rinpoche to be his teacher. So I asked Rinpoche on his behalf, and lo and behold, they said yes. So we had this like three-way pen pal thing going on, which is kind of interesting. And after that book incident happened, Rinpoche was just like, oh, that's such bad karma for the people who threw Dharma books in the dumpster. So what you need to do, rather than beat them up if they ever do that again, is you really need to dedicate your practice to them. And then at that point, I introduced him to chin-raising practice, which was the thing that Rinpoche and I agreed would be good for Ed. And it did happen again, like a year later. And what he did was he sat on his bunk, and he used the imagery of the books in the dumpster somehow as a cloud of blessings that was going out into the world and blessing all the people that were doing this. And he said that he didn't, two things happened. He didn't fight with them, didn't talk to them much either. I mean, he was honest about it, it still wasn't great, but they started to show respect when he meditated on his bunk. When you're in the dorm, that's a little hard, because it's a noisy place and somebody's going to be listening to their radio or boombox or watching TV, and you're trying to meditate. It can be chaotic. And what happened was, without him even asking, is they started supporting his practice. So in terms of how karma works, it's subtle. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, it's one of the reasons why I'm very grateful to be in this community and have good and authentic teaching. I probably wouldn't have thought of the response that Rinpoche gave to that situation. Boy, I learned a lot. And that will happen for anybody who volunteers in any capacity. We're here to support each other. And so the people that we're trying to benefit, sure, they benefit, but so do we. A lot. I'm sure I got more out of it than Ed did.
There's one thing I want to go back to just real quickly, if we could, and that's your question about karma. It's a tricky thing to talk about karma with folks in prison. I think they understand that actions produce, bad actions produce bad results. Mm-hmm. What they don't always understand is what we were saying before, is that good actions produce future good results. And that's the focus we have to have in prison, is that not about the past, it's about the future. Do you want to create a life different than you're experiencing now? So it's not about what you've done so much as what you're doing and what you will do. So it's a tricky thing to talk about. We don't want to beat people over the head with teaching on karma. So it's like that.
A previous questioner commented that she was interested more in whether the prisoners were able to be interested in and believed in purifying their karma.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, exactly.
They are, actually.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on who.
Yeah.
Some are, some aren't. I remember one guy named Zach got thrown in the hole for something he didn't do. Somebody had tried to smuggle drugs into the prison by sending him a guitar amplifier, I think.
Yeah.
And he doesn't play guitar, but they addressed it to him. And the idea was there was somebody corrupt in the mailroom that was supposed to open the amplifier, remove the drugs, and get them into circulation inside the prison. But since all that story didn't come out for whatever reason, and the thing was sent to Zach and there were drugs in it, they threw him in the hole for months. At that point, he was actually pretty ready to actually have long retreat. Now, being in the hole is really hard for 99% of all people, but he took it and he did a purification retreat. Part of that was because he understood the concept. We had brought that to him. And he had the aspiration to use skillful means, spiritual methods to work on his, you know, obscurations and hindrances and so forth. So he came out kind of like transformed. The social worker commented they were pretty surprised. Usually they come out more damaged. He came out better. So that does happen. It's possible. It's rare.
It's not every inmate that we're talking about here does what Zach did.
Right.
But there are enough of those folks that make our job, our volunteer work, worthwhile.
Yeah.
And those that do attach to the practice do it with a fierceness that's not always seen in communities. There's a fierceness about Zach's. He was going to do that.
Yeah.
And it was remarkable to see him when he came back out and tell that story, actually.
Yeah.
One of the things that prisoners are kind of big on is the idea of respect and being strong. Mm-hmm. I remember when I first started working with Azee, that, you know, people thought he was a little weird sitting on his bunk meditating. But as he kept doing it, they kept saying, gee, that's strong. They really developed a lot of respect for him. Mm-hmm. And that is a big thing in prison, is having respect and respecting strength and respecting that kind of internal courage. So.
Yes, Sydney.
Should be the last question.
The questioner asks, in the discussion so far, it sounded like they were only working with men. Was any of the work involving women?
Women can go. They're quite welcome. The men's prisons enjoy them. I did a lot of work in New Mexico in prisons, and it was a program called Alternatives to Violence. It wasn't so much a Buddhist program. But the group I went in with, there were usually three or four of us, and I was usually the only guy, and we were meeting with men.
She then asks, what about meeting with women?
Yeah.
We tried to get something going in Marysville, the women's prison here. It never got off the ground. If there's interest, we can try again. Would love to see that happen.
Yeah.
The need is there.
Same questioner. There are women in the Frank Road location, aren't there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where?
That's the county. Yeah, so I did visit a county prison once. We mostly worked with the state. We were invited to go to a federal prison, and it was too far. We can go through the details if you're interested.
The same questioner asks about potential work with juveniles as well.
Yeah, no, the need is there, getting in, getting access. We're doing a lot better on that. The laws have been very much in our favor. But when we first started this, a lot of the chaplains worked very hard at keeping non-Christians out.
Yeah.
And the other thing, just to make it clear, when we talk about like the county jail, those are counties, people are usually there for relatively short times, and then they are sentenced to a prison which is run by the state. So it's a whole different system. I went to the jail quite regularly in Santa Fe, New Mexico, the county detention center. And again, it was short time prisoners, very difficult working with the bureaucracy there. But yeah, there's a lot of possibilities if we can get some energy going and some people really committing to it.
Yeah, if you haven't guessed at this point or understood at this point, we would like to get folks interested. And if you are, talk to one of us and we will see what we could get going again. That would be really important if we could do that.
Or if you wish, you can send an email to info@columbuskTC.org and it'll get to the right place.
Do you want to add anything, Lama Kathy? I see you snuck in on us.
Thank you very much.
Want to dedicate merit? So what we do at the end is dedicate the merit. So we gather up all the merit that we have accumulated, are accumulated, will accumulate in the future. And in this case, we're going to dedicate the merit of the efforts of these folks to bring Dharma to folks who otherwise would never have heard or practiced Dharma. That was a pretty big deal. So, but each one of you, whatever merit you, just the fact you came here this morning, that's meritorious. That's a good thing. You could have done anything else besides come here, but you came here. And you listened, and that's meritorious. And so all the goodness that we have gathered here in this room, we'll gather it up and offer it for the benefit of all beings. And we'll use the prayer, the dedication of merit. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy, wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas, that I may follow in their path. I completely dedicate all this merit. Thank you very much. We all appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.